Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. We're coming to you live from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It is Wednesday, September 23rd, 2015, and this is the 79th episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talents in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is a top COO at an outstanding restaurant group, and I will introduce him in a moment. First, as I do in every show, I will start out with my PR tip. Then later, we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. Today's tip is on the importance of a strong staff. Not everyone can be or should be the top dog, or in our terms, the top chef, who is in the spotlight. Although the face of a company or restaurant often gets all the recognition, there's often a supporting team that helps make that person shine. The role of the behind-the-scenes players should not be underestimated. So appreciate the magnitude of a fabulous support crew. That's my tip today. Now, I'm really excited to have my guest here. It is Brett Trossi, the Chief Operating Officer of the Dynex Group, the management company of Danielle Ballou. In his role, Brett supervises everything from new concept development and design to construction and restaurant openings, overseeing the ongoing operation of Ballou's restaurants. He is a graduate of Cornell University's School of Hotel Administration and has served as food and beverage director at New York's Palace Hotel. Right. Okay. Welcome, Brett.
Hi, Sherry. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? I'm
doing very well today.
Well, thanks for coming out here, joining me.
Thank you so much.
To kick it off, my question from last week, I asked Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg, the award-winning culinary journalists who I had on the show. That was episode 78. I asked them to ask you a question, and their question is, how the heck are you?
I'm doing well. I was just, I think that Andrew and Karen are from Canada. And we share a mutual friend, Steve Bechta, who has a number of restaurants in Ottawa. But I just got back this week from a month in Toronto, where we reopened our Café Ballou in the Four Seasons Hotel in Toronto. So it was a very exciting project, a very beautiful restaurant. And Toronto is a super cosmopolitan city of 4 million, and really enjoyed my time there.
I was there about, I think, 2 years ago. I took a little solo trip, but I met up with an old family friend's son, and we had drinks and snacks at your restaurant, and it was lovely. So I didn't think it needed a revamp, but I guess that's why you do what you do.
Well, the Toronto also introduced a food and wine festival this year that took place a week after the film festival. And we had a series of opening events, and we had a party with Gail Simmons, who used to work with us and is also a Toronto native. So it was super nice.
I saw that actually on Twitter. I picked up about that festival. There was a lot happening last weekend.
Absolutely.
So maybe I'll have to check that out next year. Looked good. So tell me, did you always want to get into the restaurant or hotel industry? Because you did go to Cornell, or that was graduate school. So,
well, when I was a kid, my grandfather was a chef at the Brooklawn Country Club in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and I always remember going there and seeing the kettles and the tilt fryers and just just very intrigued by the kitchen. And my father absolutely hated the industry. He hated that his father was always away on all the holidays and just worked long hours. But I was somehow drawn to it, So my first job was a dishwasher at Friendly's. That I did in high school, and you know, just slowly got sucked in more and more into the industry. But I always enjoyed eating out. We used to always have a nice special birthday dinner in the restaurant of my choice, and just got into the business that way.
That's good to know. Friendly's. Mm-hmm. Where did you work first after you graduated from Cornell?
I worked at the Omni Park Central Hotel, which is now the Park Central Hotel on 7th Avenue and 56th Street. And I started as the assistant banquet manager and was able to work my way up to the food and beverage director of the hotel over the course of 4 years.
And then when did you join New York Palace and work with Le Cirque?
Well, when I was at school, I dropped out for a semester, and I had worked for Daniel Ballou as a room service cook, and then garmage at the Plaza Tanay Hotel, and so that was in 1985, and I worked there with Daniel Jonas, I worked there with Drew Nieperant, a lot of talented people went through that kitchen. And in the summer of 87, which was the summer after all of my classmates had graduated, I worked the summer at Le Cirque. So in 91, I had left the Omni Park Central, and my wife and I lived in the Caribbean for 4 years in both Bonaire and Aruba.
Nice.
And in September of 95, we moved back to take the F&B job at the Palace.
I mean, what was it like living in the Caribbean and working? That's not really work.
No, trust me, it's work because, you know, you have a clientele with very high expectations, and you have a workforce that, you have a workforce that has less urgency, not necessarily less urgency than anywhere else in the world, but you know, it's your job as a hotel executive to reconcile those two sides of the equation. But I certainly did a lot more scuba diving and tennis than I am now. So
yeah, I imagine. But did you miss the drive and the energy of a city like New York? Is that
absolutely
okay?
I would never leave again. I mean, it just every chance we could, we'd get back to New York, largely for the dining. But just the energy of New York is found in very few places.
Right. No, that's how I feel. I feel there's nothing like New York City, and you either love it or you like it and you experience it, and then you move on.
Maybe Hong Kong.
I haven't been there, so I don't know. But you'd possibly move to Hong Kong.
I'd move to Hong Kong.
Ah, wow, good thing to consider. But yeah, not for me yet. I have to visit first. So you knew Danielle from back in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
And then how did you re-meet him or get this opportunity to work with the Dynex Group?
Well, it's all really a big circle because one of the major factors where I think I got the job at the Palace was because the marketing plan was to attract Sirio and the family to bring Le Cirque to the Palace based on the fact that their lease was expiring on 65th Street and they needed a new home. And the people who had Le Cirque was originally in the Mayfair Regent Hotel, 65th and Park. And the Colony Capital had purchased it, intending to convert it to luxury condominiums, and they wanted a restaurateur to take the ground floor. And so Le Cirque moved to the palace at the same time that Coligny offered Daniel a deal to buy not just the old Le Cirque space, but almost the entire ground floor. And that's when the Dynex Group was formed. And after I had worked at the palace for 2.5 years and reopened Le Cirque 2, or opened Le Cirque 2000, then Daniel came calling. So I started back with Daniel in May of 1993.
Wow, that's a long history.
I'm sorry, May of 1998.
98, yeah. Okay, still a long history. Mm-hmm. That's when I moved to New York. So what was your initial role with Daniel?
Well, at the time, we had just the two restaurants. We had Restaurant Daniel, which was at 2076 Street, where Café Bleu is now. And we also had Paillard Patisserie and Bistro on Lexington Avenue. So I work with Francois.
Yeah, I love Francois.
So do I. So do I. And the plan was to move Daniel at that point and open Café Bleu, as we did. But I started in March. We closed Daniel in July. We opened Café Bleu in September, and then Restaurant Daniel in its current iteration opened in January of 99.
I've been to the new iterations of the places. I didn't get to the old ones, but I'm such a huge fan of Daniel Bleu and all of his restaurants, and I'm pretty in awe of the company and what you do. So what's like a day in the life? Like, how do you... concept development or new restaurants, like how do you manage, or what are you doing, or with these new openings, how did it work with creating new restaurants?
Well, there's no typical day. Anyone who knows Daniel well knows that he likes to juggle a lot of balls at the same time, and is really never satisfied with what he has or the quality level of anything. And so that's the love of my job, is there's no typical day. We have challenges in different restaurants and different places. We have tastings, we have meetings and conference calls. So there's just, we're running in a lot of different directions.
Yeah, well, I read in another bio of yours I saw online about how your professionalism, stubbornly positive attitude, and flexible approach complement Danielle's energy and creativity.
Thank you, Georgette Farkas.
Georgette, that's, love Georgette too. She's that seems to make sense. I mean, knowing Danielle, he is. I've never worked with him, but just I see the energy, and you know the creativity's there, so. You must balance him out.
Right. Well, I think that I do, and I'm able to follow through on some of his ideas. And he's really forced to move from item to item to event very, very quickly. And so I take it from there and execute what we want to go forward. And kind of wrap up those things that that we don't.
Yeah, you make it sound easy, simple. But I mean, he's out and about. I see him at a lot of events, and not only I might be there attending, but he's hosting it. You mm-hmm. know, he's the one cooking and leading the show. It's
right.
a lot.
Right, right. And he, it's his nature never to be satisfied. So when we do an event, he's always adding layers to it and complexity to it. And in the end, just like the food or restaurant design, it's constantly improving things. But, you know, doing it on the fly can also be challenging at times. But we all understand our role. We know that and it's easy because we admire the man so much, but always trying to paint him in the most positive light. And if we throw a party, we want it to be the most memorable party that you go to that week or month or year.
Well, you do a great job at that. And I think you do accomplish that, especially when Danielle gets on the bar, which he likes to do. Mm-hmm. And it's always a great showcase of food and hospitality. So, at least from my eyes.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to take a little break here and come back, talk some more with Brett. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Brett Trossi, Chief Operating Officer at the Dynex Group. So I was on your website counting how many restaurants are now currently in the Dynex Group, and I got 17.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
correct?
Okay.
Very accurate.
With 8 in New York. So, I mean, it seems... Let's talk about New York City first, because there's Danielle, which the flagship, the most elegant, and then a lot of the other ones, like the a little more casual, but maybe you can explain like the different styles of restaurants and then how you work with them or how the concepts came about being developed.
Well, one of our major challenges financially is that even our most casual restaurant, DBGB, is not that casual.
True.
In a way, and we more often than not buy the same food as we do, certainly at Cafe Blue, but oftentimes the same vendors as Danielle, and our service levels and staffing levels are very high. We're not cutting corners, and so that's a big challenge for us. But, you know, we try and tailor the formality of each restaurant and the theme to the neighborhood that it's in and the trends at the time. And whenever we open a restaurant, we always feel like, okay, this is the one that we can replicate and cookie cutter. But the reality is that... it's not as interesting to cookie cutter as to come up with something new every time. So we really look at it like children, where you can seemingly develop and raise two children the same way and they turn out completely opposite or certainly distinct individuals.
That's a good analogy. Yeah, well, I've been to all the ones in New York, and actually, I was thinking about this at Cafe Baloo when Gavin was there,
mm-hmm.
another great person. I had my celebrity sighting. Woody Allen was there that night.
Mm-hmm. He lives right around the corner.
I think you get a little more the Upper East Side, maybe celebrity type mm-hmm. following. I live by Columbus Circle and Lincoln Center. So mm-hmm. you have Blue Sud, you have Barbaloo, and I can't pronounce it. How do you, the cafe?
A Pizzeria Baloo.
Yeah. I would blow that. but I love having them in the neighborhood. I feel they're a little more, I guess, approachable than maybe, or I could be more of a regular there, at least budget wise, or I don't know, price point. Is it that different, or am I just thinking?
No. There, the three operations there are on three slightly different levels. They all share. They have each have their separate kitchens, but they all share the same receiving and employee facilities. But Balut Zud would be the most formal and upscale of the three. And it's nice for a special occasion. It's great before the opera. Bar Bleu is a little bit more walk-in. It has that huge terrace in front of it. And it's just used by so many neighbors and so many residents there on a, let's not say, if not a daily basis, but certainly weekly. We have weekly regulars and monthly regulars. There's a lot of people. And the love of a Pizzeria Balut and the Oyster Bar on a day like today when we can throw open the sliding glass doors and you could have a hot dog or a half dozen oysters and a glass of rosé. It's really, if I were to go to a concert at Lincoln Center, I'm sure I would be running and late. And a pizzeria is perfect to stop off at quarter to the, you know, even 7 o'clock. Have, again, a sandwich or a salad, a cup of coffee, a glass of champagne, and off to the symphony.
It's great for the neighborhood, and even the look of it when you walk by, there's always a great energy coming out of the sidewalk seating. And I love being nearby. When you're putting restaurants in other cities and the others, well, first, how have you chosen the other cities Daniel's opened in? And it seems those restaurants are on the more the casual side. Maybe, or I don't know, there's a lot of, I didn't write down all of the different names. There was a lot of Balut something.
Right. there's a lot of Balut going around out there.
Yeah.
Well, the first one that we opened in 2003 outside of New York was at Cafe Balut in Palm Beach. And we did that because so many of our customers find themselves there in the winter. And for all the things that that people say to malign it, it's a fun place to be. And our regulars are often there in the winter. And so we've always been very successful. That was very easy for us. But we have several different concepts with similar partners or the same partners. For example, we opened a Bar Balut in London with Mandarin Oriental Hotels. We just couldn't resist the glamour of London and the Mandarin, which backs up to Hyde Park. And that restaurant has been an absolute home run and pleasure to operate since the day it opened. And so recently we opened a Bar Balut at the Mandarin in Boston. Again, beautiful hotel, right located 50 or 100 feet from the finish line of the Boston Marathon. And again, beautiful design by Adam Tahani, and it's been great. And by the same token, our restaurant in Las Vegas is in the Venetian Casino, which is the same owner as our DB Bistro in Singapore.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. How often are you traveling to these different cities and visiting the properties?
There's really no hard and fast equation for that. There are times where you need to be in certain restaurants more, like with this renovation that we've taken on in Toronto. I've been there a lot this year. Our general manager, after many years, left in Singapore. So I've been to Singapore twice this year and we'll probably have a follow-up visit later on this year.
Do you have any time to sightsee when you're there, or is it all business?
No, Thomas Keller once told me if you like the city, never open a restaurant there.
It's funny. Yeah, that makes sense. What would you say are do you love most about your job, and or what are the challenges?
Well, the I think the challenges are keeping all the details going at the same time, and really knowing when to take control of a situation or a problem, and when to let the chefs and general managers run with it as well. What I like about it is that it's absolutely different every day. And a lot of times, I feel like the general manager of the Yankees or maybe even the Mets, but that I'm really privileged to be the leader of an organization that has so many talented people, in it, and people who are just so passionate about cooking, about beer, about wine, about service, and that's really a privilege.
That's a great way to close this part of the show, because I love that. And okay, I'm not going to say anything else. We're going to close this part of this show, and we're going to take a little break, and we're going to come back. We're going to do my speed round game and talk some industry news. So this is all in the industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Still paying attention? Are you there? Hello, 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 hello. I'm talking to you. Hi. Hey, this is Jack Inslee. I'm the executive producer here at Heritage Radio Network. I've been here at the station since 2009, and I cannot believe just how much this network has grown over that time. We've been able to grow because of donations from people like you. So if you're enjoying this, if you laughed, if you learned something, contribute anything. $1, $2, $10, $100, $1,000, anything counts. And trust me, we'll appreciate seeing your name come through on the donations. So consider visiting heritageradionetwork.org, click on that little beating heart, the donate button, and show us you care. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
Okay, we're back. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Brett Trossi, the Chief Operating Officer at the Dynex Group. It's time for my speed round game. So what this is I name two things, and you just pick your preference.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Here we go.
I'm nervous.
Don't be nervous. Eat in or eat out?
Eat out.
Wine, beer, cocktail, or mocktail?
Beer.
Tasting menu or a la carte?
A la carte.
Small plates or large plates?
Large.
Communal table or chef's counter?
Both.
Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
Tipping.
Hotel restaurants or independent restaurants?
Independent.
Giants or Jets?
Clearly Giants.
I read that somewhere too. Two more. Cheese plate or dessert?
Dessert.
Manhattan or Brooklyn?
Brooklyn.
You got the speed of the game. You're excellent.
Thank you.
Yeah, some people the show turns into the game because it turns into just a long conversation about every answer.
Well, I have plenty of opinions about some of those questions, but
well, one of them, which is in my industry news, I don't know if you get your opinion on this one. So let's talk about this article that was in Eater last week. Tom Colicchio eliminates tipping during Kraft's lunch service. Dinner could follow. It's by Ryan Sutton. So what I've found doing my game is that this I ask the tipping or all-inclusive charge question, and it's changed. I have to go back and listen to get the number count, but up to about 50 episodes, everyone was tipping. Slowly, it's kind of people are hesitating on it. So this is Tom Colicchio, who people know from Top Chef Judge and of his craft restaurants, formerly of Gramercy Tavern, very well popular chef. So he's decided for lunch he's going to say prices are all inclusive. He's removing the tip line from credit cards, checks, and he's guaranteeing a higher base wage for his staff. So what do you think? And is this something Danielle might, or you guys might consider doing?
Well, first of all, it's a much more complicated issue than I think the general public realizes. I at our end of the business, and I certainly include Tom in that, that I think in the long term, it will hurt the front of the house staff for the benefit of the back of the house staff. I don't think really in either case it will benefit the hotel the restaurant operator in any way. But I do think the way the laws are set up and the way the law protects the tips and the tip pool and to really those safeguards that make sure that when you pay a tip, it goes to the person who gave you service, that the servers are particularly well protected in New York State. And so that's why you have a situation where in an upscale restaurant, your captain or even your busser is making 50 or 60 or 80 or 100,000, and where your cooks are making 35 or 45 or 50,000. And whenever tips are involved or even a service charge, people think when they see service charge on their check, that's something that can be shared with the back. Well, in the back of the house in New York State, it can't. So I think as time goes on, that the waiters will find that their hourly rate will shrink, and that will be used for a number of reasons, but I think it will also be used to have the back of the house wages grow. So I'm not sure that at our end of the business, at the high end of the business, that it will really long-term benefit the front of the house staff.
Yeah, it is a complicated issue. I don't know. I have lots of thoughts in my head, just even back. Well, when I lived in Chicago, I was a server at Charlie Trotter's, and I was salaried, and that was in 1997. Mm-hmm. And then I got a job as a, I left to cook. I was a server there, and I was at Garmanger cook at a jazz club making $7 an hour. And I kept thinking, the service, the waiters, they're making like triple what I'm making. Like, what am I doing back here? Mm-hmm. So I think there has always been that difference between the back of the house and the front of the house. And it seems this is a direction things might go to even it out. And I don't know if both, well, I think cooks will be happy, but I don't know service staff, how it's a huge change.
Well, that's my point exactly. There are waitresses in Las Vegas, or any other place that might work 3 days a week and make $1,000 a night when they work. So going forward, if you ran that nightclub, would you need to continue to pay someone $200 an hour in order to work there? Or do you think you can find an adequate employee for 150 or 100? And what will happen to that extra money that you used to pay that's now built into the price?
Right.
So again, and we're talking a very specialized and a very small slice of the industry, but within our slice, all-inclusive pricing is not the simple way to go answer.
Okay. Well, I'm following this story. It's I think it's not going to go away. It's just going to keep adding on what's happening.
I think the trend will continue, and I think that we may very well, speaking about our company, and Danielle, will get there. But I certainly, in our case, we're not ready to go there. And it's just a extremely complicated concept. People who think that it immediately solves some problem that our wait staff is impoverished is not the case in upscale restaurants.
I agree. All right. Well, I'll keep on this story. So another article today that came out in the New York Times Restaurant Review, Gabriel Kruther, that's how I'm pronouncing it, mm-hmm. 3 stars by Pete Wells. And have you been to?
I have been. Okay. It's very close to DB Bistro on Gabriel's right. restaurant. Mm-hmm. It's on 42nd. We're on 44th. But I was very impressed.
Yes.
I was very impressed. I thought that 3 stars is very well deserved. The restaurant feels very fresh and a little more casual. It's clear that Gabriel does not want to be a casual restaurant and has been afforded the opportunity to do something spectacular, but it doesn't feel stuffy at all. It feels very fresh. I like the colors and I like the creativity and thought that's gone into absolutely everything there.
Yeah, I agree. I dined there and I had a great meal, and the design, which Glenn Coben did, I think he somehow was able to make it feel comfortable, yet it is a refined, elegant setting. I think their price point, being 4 courses, $98, people might laugh that I'm saying this, but I think it's very reasonable for especially what tasting menus are charging nowadays. Most tasting menus are close to 200, 250, it seems, in a lot of the pop-up restaurants. And so I felt there was value. There was a lot of courses, and it was delicious. Mm. And service was great. So,
and I think it's a good location for that. It's in Midtown, so you don't have to scurry home and find a tie to wear. Not that you couldn't go in blue jeans, because that's certainly the nature of dining these days. But I was very impressed.
Yeah, well, he did split it like the modern where he came from, with the bar menu is separate than the dining menu. And I had stopped in there early on and went to the bar, and I just had his flambé, the tart flambé that he's known for.
Right.
And it's a nice place that you can stop in there and do that as well. So whatever you're looking for, but I'm happy for them. Congratulations!
Mm-hmm. It's perfect for after the movies at Bryant Park.
Well, yeah.
Maybe not. Maybe.
Well, I think that's it. I guess, yeah, no, it is. You're right. Because you can go in there casual. Mm. And it's a great location. I mean, right across from the park. It's terrific. Good for Midtown. So the last thing I have is I just wanted to announce that coming up, there is a festival, PR Meets NYC. It's Wednesday, September 30th, through Sunday, October 4th. And this, my friend, is the founder. It's Marie Elena Martinez of Meets NYC. And so this is, PR does not stand for public relations, believe it or not. It stands for Puerto Rico. So it's Puerto Rico Meets NYC. And they're bringing in top chefs from Puerto Rico to cook along with New York City's best chefs like Eric Repair. They have Camille Becerra and J.J. Johnson. And from Puerto Rico, they have Jose Santella and Mario Pagan. And I'm going solo to one of the dinners with Roberto Trevino and Eric Greenspan. They're doing their El Nosh dinner at the Hotel Americano. So I'm going to be going. So if you want to check it out, it's meetsnyc.com. And on that note, we're going to take one more break. Come back. I'm going to do my solo dining experience. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. It's time for my solo dining experience, which this week is at Sadell's. Here's the rundown. Location, 463 West Broadway in Soho, NYC. The concept, a bakery and restaurant from Major Food Group, specializing in smoked fish, house-made bagels, and other Jewish appetizing fare, a fitting menu considering today is Yom Kippur. The owners, Rich Teresi, Mario Carbone, and Jeff Zelaznik, in partnership with baker Melissa Weller. Why did I go? Because everyone's talking about bagels, and this restaurant group is on fire. My experience. I stopped in for lunch and was seated at a two-top up front near the takeout bakery. The space is really nice with high ceilings and natural light. Service was friendly and eager to please. What did I get? The house salmon platter with chive cream cheese and an everything house-made bagel. It was served on a tower with tomato, cucumbers, and onions, plus an extra bagel. It was fancy. I also had coffee and I got a sticky bun to go. My take. Super fresh salmon and bagels, a winning combo, and the sticky bun was finger-licking good. The scene, stylish New Yorkers, perfect for Jewish deli cravings and breaking the fast. Interesting tidbits. Jeff Zelaznik met Melissa Weller at Smorgasburg, where she was serving her bagels. She had previously worked at Per Se. Personal fun fact, bagels and lox is my favorite brunch or breakfast. Not that I have it every day. The cost, $19, not including tax and gratuity. Would I go back? Definitely. I have to try that babka. Website, sadells.com. Have you been there yet, Brett?
No, I haven't been. They sent me an email for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur catering. But I hadn't known anything about it at that point. So I look forward to going.
Well, it was funny. I was just planning. I didn't plan to do this review on Yom Kippur. It just happened that I went, and then I was like, oh, this is very timely.
Better be lucky than good any day.
Yeah, no. And it's great. I would definitely go back. I don't know how these guys are pushing out all these amazing restaurants.
I don't know, but I totally agree with you. They are alumni of Cafe Bleu under the Andrew Carmelini regime. So
nice.
Interesting to note.
Yeah, good. Another interesting tidbit. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's time for the final question. My next guest is Jamie Schweed. He is the executive vice president of Schweed & Sons, a fourth-generation meat purveyor, specifically of burgers. So, Brett, can you ask Jamie a question?
Jamie, my question is, why does the price of beef keep going up and up and up? Why don't they raise more cattle? I don't get it.
I will find out. I don't know.
I don't know why. You would think if there's a supply and a demand problem, it would be not overly complicated to raise more cattle, you would think.
Okay.
I'm sure there's five more sides to it that I don't
know. It's probably complicated, like the tipping.
Yes, absolutely.
But I will ask him, so thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed being on the show.
Well, I enjoyed having you on the show. And as I said, I'm a big fan of the Dynex group and Daniel Bleu and you and everything you do. So thank you for providing these amazing restaurants and hospitality.
Well, please, we'll see you in one of the restaurants soon.
Yes, you certainly will. So my guest today has been Brett Trossi, Chief Operating Officer at the Dynex Group. Their website's daniellebleu.com. You can find them on social media at btrossi, at Bleu Careers, and at Daniel Bleu. You can find me at Sherry Bayer, at Bayer PR, at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry, and my website's BayerPublicRelations.com. As a reminder, all of our shows are archived on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We have a brand new site. Check it out. We're also on Stitcher and iTunes, so you can download our episodes as podcasts and listen anywhere, anytime. Thanks to Brett, my engineer Liz, our sponsors, and everyone listening. I'm Sherry Bayer, and I'll be back next Wednesday at 4 with another live show. Thanks for being part of All in the Industry. Bye.
Thank Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.